History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there. Welcome to Spy Talk. I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And Jeff Stein is indisposed today, so it's just going to be Karen and I. And we've got a great guest for this episode, Gina Bennett, veteran CIA analyst, legendary CIA analyst, actually, because she was the person at the CIA who first identified Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda as the threat that they were to the United States. And that was years before anybody else was doing so. So we're going to have a fascinating discussion. She's also an author of a new book that Karen has gone through. But before I do, we just want to just talk a little bit about items in the news this week that struck us. Karen, I know you've got one that you're pretty exercised about.
I was really struck by the story, which is really flagged for the public by Senator Mark Warner, about a meeting that was held with Republicans, but not with Democrats, by top figures in the administration, a briefing on what's going on in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific in terms of these attacks on alleged drug traffickers in boats. And the idea that part of Congress would not be briefed really seemed like a new level of politicization of our congressional leaders. And as you know, I mean, the strikes continue to go on these boats. I think there are 61 dead so far.
We've killed over 61 people. We have no idea who they were or what role they were playing in drug trafficking. We're just blowing these boats out of the water under what legal authority?
Well, that's the interesting part. That's the interesting part. What was also revealed recently was that the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice did, in fact, write a memo that justifying legally these attacks in the name of preventing against an imminent harm to Americans. And so it's getting very complicated in terms of how many branches of government are supporting these strikes, which fall somewhere between crime and it looks like and war. And there it's getting more and more uncomfortable and more heated. And really, it's a question of how far is this going to go? And are we on the precipice in being in some kind of warfare situation?
Excellent questions and quite pressing. I've got one other that I just briefly want to flag because it comes off of our episode just a week or so ago about the movie A House of Dynamite. Now, we have followed, and in that movie, and we had Larry Pfeiffer, former director of the White House sit room, and who was a technical consultant to A House of Dynamite on the show, and talking about how accurate that the film was in depicting these two, this strategic center for a White House response to any national security threat. But remember, they also then later in the movie go to something called the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, which is a bunker that top officials go to when there might be some threat to the White House. Why do I bring this up now? Do you know where the Presidential Emergency Operations Center is located? Under what part of the White House it's located?
Are you going to tell me the East Wing?
The East Wing. It was first built by Franklin Roosevelt in 1943, in the wake of Pearl Harbor. The White House needed a bunker to protect. It's under the East Wing of the White House. So the question has arisen. They've torn down the East Wing. How does one get to the bunker? Is the bunker still even there? Is there a presidential bunker that that Trump and top officials can go to? We don't know. I did ask Larry Pfeiffer, who was the technical consultant.
What'd he say?
To House of Dynamite. And he was not as helpful as I was hoping. He wrote back, I can't go into any detail about the PEOC, Presidential Emergency Operations Center, given their classification and sensitivity. I would only offer that I'm confident the White House Military Office, WHMO, which is responsible for those activities, would have mitigated the impact, if there were any, of the destruction of the East Wing on those activities. Not totally satisfying. And I have seen no mention in any of the coverage over the last couple of weeks about the destruction of the East Wing, that there is this sensitive emergency bunker underneath it. I just flag it. And anybody listening to Spy Talk today has any ideas or thoughts or information, please let us know. I think it's a pretty interesting and pressing question. And anyway, on that note, let's get to our guest, Gina Bennett. We are now joined by Gina Bennett, legendary CIA analyst. Gina, welcome to Spy Talk.
Oh, thank you. I think legendary might be a stretch, but thank you.
I think you meet the test, our test for legendary. Anyway, look, there's a lot we want to talk to you about your career at the CIA, about what's going on these days. And of course, you have a new book out, which Karen is going to grill you about. But before we go there. You are principally known because you were the first to identify the threat of Osama bin Laden, and you did it years before anybody in the American public even knew who he was. Extrapolating from that, when you look at the world today, what are the threats that you see that perhaps we're not paying enough attention to and could be a future threat to our national security?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And the list is quite long. But I want to end it with a cheerful note, which is unusual in the world of counterterrorism and national security to have
Especially these days.
Well, ever, really, but whenever you're talking about threats. But, you know, of course, there are always threats that we are not paying close enough attention to. It's not that we aren't paying close enough attention to. It's just that only in hindsight do you know any one of the many that people are tracking is the one that actually surfaces, you know, with the opportunity, the context, the setting, the adversary, the timing, all that sort of stuff. And it bubbles up to become kind of the omnipresent problem of tomorrow. It's so easy in hindsight to say, oh, we should have paid more attention to all of this. But in the current, you know, there's only but so many people and so many resources and so much time. So I think it's important to just know that there's always going to be surprises. There's no amount of resources you can put at national security to prevent all surprise. So there's that. I think one of the things that I grappled with as I was retiring in mid-2022, because I was really one of the last counterterrorism analysts to have had any history with the Cold War, you know, where we were dealing with terrorism and counterterrorism that was state sponsored and state related and was, you know, part of the Cold War, was an entire generation of folks who only thought of terrorism as a non-state actor activity. And that is, of course, not the case. So I worry a little bit that, you know, it's always like fighting the last war, right? Where we have an entire structure and set of institutions and experts who came out post, you know, came up post 9/11. So we really do need to remember that terrorism, as well as many other types of assaults on the integrity of a nation, can come from state actors as well as non-state.
So which state actors and which particular terrorist threats worry you the most?
Well, that depends how you define terrorism. And, you know, from my perspective, the greatest terrorist threat in the entire world has been and always will be the threat to women. Because politicized, you know, misogyny enables women to be assaulted and attacked in their homes and outside their homes without much in terms of repercussions. So it's not, we don't counter it the way we counter violence by a total stranger. But if you're the victim of violence, it doesn't matter who committed it. It's worse, actually, if it's someone you trusted. Nonetheless, in the more conventional sense of terrorism, I do think it, again, it depends perspective. In the United States, it's quite clearly the political violence that's brewing and occurring, you know, from our polarization, our unwillingness to see each other, even if we're on opposite sides of the political or social spectrum, to tolerate and respect each other's rights to just live, right? We've othered each other so much that, you know, whether you're on the right or the left, doesn't really matter. You're seeing the other as inhuman and, you know, evil. And anytime narratives go down that track, it's a horrible threat because you have completely taken away humanity. So that worries me a lot. I mean, the incel movement in the United States worries me a great deal because we're seeing a resurgence of, again, harassment of young girls and girls, teenage girls and young women.
The incel movement, tell us exactly what you're referring to there.
The involuntary celibates, the young men who believe they are owed women. And when they are rejected, they become very degrading and violent against women. It is a spectrum of misogyny that is, you know, more acceptable in the male space. Than you don't see a lot of women misandrous. You know, most people don't even know what the word is because it's just not common. I mean, women don't do the same kind of thing about men that men do with women. So, it's a fairly commonplace and growing problem. But, you know, in terms of states, because you asked about state actors, I mean, you know, any state that finds an advantage in using some type of shock attack is going to consider terrorism as a tool that ranges from Russia and China to Israel, Iran, you know, any country in the world, really. We are not without that problem as well. So I just think it's important to remember that it is a tactic that's possible. Nowadays, of course, there's so many ways of causing mass disruption in the cyberspace and informational space. And I think we get caught up a little bit in terms of the, and I'm getting to my good news point. We get caught up a lot.
We were waiting for that.
Yes, I know. We get caught up a lot in the means. You know, we worry about terrorist means, cyber means, you know, misinformation, disinformation, deep fakes, AI making mistakes, agentic AI, things like this. We worry about the means, but if we also need to focus on to the what end, you know, to what end, is it to conquer the United States of America and actually come over here and take over our land and our people and turn us into something else? Probably not as much these days as back in colonial days when that was much more the norm with, you know, international and empires and stuff like that. Is it to destabilize the United States? Is it to disintegrate our democratic institutions? You know, what is the towards what end? To cause mass economic chaos or panic? There's a lot of ways to do those, to bring about those ends that don't cost money. They don't involve a missile. They don't involve a terrorist attack. I mean, they might, but they don't have to. And when you're an adversary, you're going to go with maximum impact towards the ends you're trying to achieve with lowest level of effort, most plausible deniability, and, you know, and something that you can do again, preferably. So
well, the Russians are kind of masters at this,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I mean,
they are
sure.
The prime example.
So anyways, so when you think about the to what end, this is where every person in the United States of America and every person in any other country that's facing similar problems, every person has the ability to be far more effective at neutralizing those adversaries' objectives than they think. Because really what they want to do is change who we are, what we believe in, the kind of governance we seek to have. No matter how polarized we are on any given day, the Constitution, the Democratic Republic that we have set up, that is what they're trying to shake and just rattle and destroy. We, and only we, have the ability to prevent that from happening. And only we have the ability to actually allow it to happen. So it really, it's not about the military or anything else. It's about the people of America believing in America.
But when you say we, it's interesting because you're taking, you don't mean we, the government.
No, I mean, we, the people.
You mean we, the people, in the, you know, hundreds of years since the founding of the country. And so things like the protests that have been going on, No King's Day, and this emphasis on community at the local level that sort of emphasizes local problems, but also local bonding. Is this so the thing about this is sort of interesting is that it's on us instead of on our government. And isn't that in and of itself a comment on what democracy is and isn't?
I think it's more a comment on a lack of education in our, you know, our grade school system. You know, we just don't take civics seriously, which defies my understanding because as a parent, I know, you know, as soon as those kids are born, you're trying to get them to a place where they don't need you anymore, right? I have five kids, so I hustled to try to enable them to be productive people in the world, right? And we should be doing that for everyone. If this is a government of, for, and by the people, then we want to make sure the people understand the government that they're in charge of, that they are, you know, this is a government of the people.
Right.
So that should have been a much more deliberate and a higher priority. But I also think, Karen, what you're saying is, I think we have also forgotten that the government isn't owned by somebody else. The government, yeah. You know, the executive, Donald Trump or any other president doesn't own any of it. It's not theirs. It's
including
ours.
The White House. Including
no,
the White House.
No, the White House is not his either. The entire thing is we the people's.
Yeah.
It's our Justice Department. It's our, you know, Defense Department. It's ours. It's not any one president's or leader's or Congress. It belongs to all of us.
So as you know, Gina, I mean, there's been continuing controversy about the intelligence community during the Trump administration and the extent to which it has been politicized and weaponized and gone after people who worked in the agency, presumably you worked closely with over the years, stripped of their security clearance or pushed out of jobs. As you look at how all this has unfolded, give us your take, how worried or concerned you are about what you're seeing, about what's going on in the place you worked at for more than 30 years.
Yeah. So I have I'm a contrarian, you know, and so I see things a little bit differently than I think most people do. And I've also watched a lot of change, you know, over the course of my career. So I had, you know, upfront seats to a lot of it, since it was still the Cold War when I started under Ronald Reagan. And, you know, one thing I believe in absolutely is the pendulum. It's gonna swing back, you know, and every time you swing it too hard in one direction, it zooms back in the other way. And I believe that is going to be the case. And I don't think that's good for anybody. So I do think this particular time where we are talking about politics, you know, it's like a common occurrence. We're talking about what does it mean to believe in this party or that party's agenda. We're caring about voting more than we ever did before. And I think people lose track of some of the positive indicators. This is not yet the Civil War. Hopefully we will not have to have a civil war in that conventional sense. I mean, maybe we need to divorce, you know, maybe the Democratic states and the Republican states need to separate for a while functionally. But I do believe that in the long term, in the bigger picture, and coming from the agency, you know, there's one thing I know that is more important than anything else. And that is, you know, we take an oath to serve the Constitution. We don't serve a set of policies or a set of people. And, you know, I've been through Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden. And then I haven't served Trump a second time, but in serving the Constitution, you adopt the entire country as your family, and you care about them, even the people who hate you, as much as you would your relatives. And when you do that, you will put up with a lot of hardship, attacks, whether it's from the public or from, in this case, the executive office. Because you know that what you're doing is for the security of not just the nation now, but in the future. So you're not going to shake the CIA. It's not going to happen. It's not breakable, I don't think, because the people in it sacrificed their life for that oath. And that's different from sacrificing your life in the sense of dying for it, you know, in a military skirmish or a war. I mean, yes, absolutely. I've had colleagues killed in the war on terrorism, for example. And so, yes, you will die for it. But to live with it, to live your mission for the folks undercover, for example, to live undercover, to live the life that you have to live in order to do that mission, you sacrifice the person that you could have otherwise been. That sacrifice is done willingly because, more than anything else, they believe in the Constitution and they believe in the mission of keeping this country safe.
Do you believe those values that you've just described, allegiance to the Constitution, caring about the whole country, are shared by the people now at the highest levels in the intelligence community, at the CIA and at ODNI?
At the very highest levels, it almost doesn't matter if they do or don't. I'm sorry. The highest levels are just not that important. I mean no disrespect to my seniors of the past or the present, but that's not where the functions occur. That's not where the daily grind
Except
happens.
That the people at the highest levels are firing people who used to be your colleagues, stripping them of the security clearances.
Yes, they are.
But what you're saying is the institutional culture is extremely strong, and yes, that it supports a kind of structural integrity that you think is there. You know, I want to pick up there because a lot of what you said sort of resonated with me with your first two books, National Security Mom and the second volume, National Security Mom, and sort of this overlay between what it is it means to parent and to be a mother, and those skills that you have to bring to the to the table when you're trying to protect the country and think about how to protect the country in national security terms. And before we get to your newest book, I just wanted to ask you to sort of, you know, what made you decide that that was how you would lay out your, had you been thinking this for a long time? You know, when did that get into your mind? Was it, you know, when your firstborn was born? Was it before that? What, when did this become the metaphor for you?
You know, really from the, even before I had children, because when I walked in the door, you know, 1988, again, in national security, intelligence, I was almost immediately drawn to counterterrorism. I was in counterterrorism right away. Pan Am 103 and all that. And, you know, I think, and we were, it was still the Cold War. I mean, I did duck and cover drills when I was young because my my father was in the military. We lived on a base. And so it was, you know, just part of the culture. And I knew going in, I did not realize that our national security apparatus was so focused on tangible national safety and our borders. And I mean, not saying that those things are not important, but the safety of our buildings, the safety of our infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And there was absolutely no focus really on national security, the security of our institutions, of our ideals, of the Constitution. And that really surprised me because growing up as a girl, I was never safe ever. And in fact, I experienced childhood sexual assault on a regular basis. And so I never thought I knew I was never safe. I was never tangibly, physically safe. And I didn't just crumple up and give up, right? I decided that my security is something that I own. You know, it's my resilience. It's my ability to decide for myself what I believe in, that there's still joy in the world, that I can still trust people, that I, you know, that I can still love and be a happy person. That's not easy. But if I can do it at the age of 6, I think that the nation can do it, right? So that's really, really from the very beginning. Obviously, after having children, I found myself teaching my children these things. Like, here's, if you make this mess, you clean it up. You know, don't say that if you aren't going to follow through and you absolutely mean it. Just the small things that we tell our children are no different when we go from being a tiny family to a nation talking to other nations. It's just one family talking to another. I mean, that's how politics started, right?
So there's a lot in there, but you know, one thing that I just want to emphasize in addition to the big takeaways from what you just said is this inclusion of the notion of safety in the idea of security, which, you know, doesn't always happen. Yeah. And it's sort of interesting to hear it together. I want to talk to about your new book, which is a historical spy thriller and a new medium for you and what you've decided to do in this phase of your career. And if two of them are dead. And I wanted you first, before we get into it, just to tell us the anecdote behind the title.
Oh, yeah. So because the book features, not exclusively, but there are two female spy characters that I have chosen for reasons that you may ask in a subsequent question. I don't know. But so because of that, they have a conversation and it's set in the revolution or partially set in the Revolutionary War timeframe. And Benjamin Franklin was known to have said or claimed to have said, three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. He did not have a lot of faith in espionage and spying and George Washington's, you know, spy rings. Yet he was on the committee that was supposed to fund them. So I have one of my spies say, well, clearly Benjamin Franklin has never met a female spy.
Right. So it's sort of, and I think a lot of people who read the book may know that, but it becomes very clear as you're writing it. So, you know, the book takes place, and I'm going to try to not have any spoiler you know, alerts here. But, you know, it takes place basically between these two, as you say, spies, one from the Revolutionary War period and one from right now, 2024 in the book. And before we get, so there's two things going on, two different quests that have to do with how can we analyze and catch people who are trying to harm what it is we believe in, you know, as a country forming, as a country that exists. And so just tell us a little bit about the Culper spy ring that you write about from the revolutionary time so we can set this.
Sure. So the Culper spy ring is probably the best known spy ring from the Revolutionary War time period, based in, you know, based on Long Island and Setauket to start with. And this is a bit of George Washington's experiment along with Benjamin Talmadge, one of his aides-de-camp, I believe. But, you know, they were instrumental in a number of activities that helped prevent the British from completely controlling New York and, you know, just having this strategic advantage in the war. And not only in acquiring intelligence and gathering intelligence, but then ultimately in planting false information. So a lot of people don't realize, but I think one of the major coups of the Culper spy ring, in my opinion anyway, is having convinced the British that when the French fleet, you know, it takes a while for the fleet to get over. So it's not like people didn't know the French fleet was coming to help support the Patriots. But when the French fleet was sailing over, this is a big problem for the British Navy, and they wanted to know whether or not it was coming north or south. You know, was it going to come up and defend the Continental Navy in the New York area or down in the Virginia area? And so the disinformation campaign was to persuade the Brits that it was splitting in two, and some of it was going north and some of it was going south. So that the Brits did the same thing. They split their defenses north and south, when in fact, all of it went south. And so that's where they beat them.
And one of your characters plays a pivotal role in this. Is this a historical character?
Yes.
You didn't make her up?
No. Although some historians deny she existed.
Who is the character?
Well, if you go back to the Culper spy code book, the Culper spy code book actually exists, and you can look it up in the archives. And I believe George Washington was number 9 something, or maybe he was, I don't remember, actually don't quote me on that, 711 or whatever. Everybody had a number. The different individuals had a number, and the number 355 was equated with a lady, just, you know, a lady. And in the vernacular at the time, that meant somebody of social standing, not a woman, not a barmaid, you know, something like that. And there are a couple of letters that refer to her, a couple of letters among Culper spy ring members, Robert Townsend and Woodhull, Abraham Woodhull, that refer to 355 as having passed certain information. So the belief is 355 was a specific individual. And then there's a lot of debate then about who she was, where she was located. So most of it is inferred that she was a lady probably who ran in the same social circles as Major John André, who was the British spy master, or at least in Tory social circles where she could have picked up some of the information that she then passed along.
Wasn't André the one who recruited or worked with Benedict Arnold?
Yes.
Does he factor into your story?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Well, do tell.
Well, he is who he is.
Yeah.
There's
a traitor.
Well, he's a Brit. He's not a traitor to his country.
Wait, no. Benedict Arnold.
Oh, yeah. No. Benedict Arnold.
Was the traitor. He was a general in Washington's army who then defected.
Yep.
So that's the revolutionary war context. Right. But then you have the 2024 war context, also a woman with a biblical name. You have Sarah on the one hand, Ruth on the other hand, Ruth in 2024. And she too has a problem that she's trying to address, which
is— Wait a second, is this the same book?
Yes, this is the same book.
We go from the Revolutionary War to 2024?
Yes, yes. Okay. And we won't tell you how, because that's a spoiler alert and you'll have to find out. And so, but then we have the 2024 context, and they're obsessed with, to pick a better, you know, to pick a word, the fourth man theory.
Yes, right.
And so, which I know, and you credit in the book Bob Baer and his book and the subsequent movie, but just enlighten us on what the fourth man theory was.
Yeah. And I am definitely not an expert in this realm, so I'm sure I'll do them all a disservice. But the fourth man theory was that in addition to the three best known Cold War or Soviet spies, moles that were in the United States, Robert Hansen, Rick Ames, and the other guy, I cannot remember his name.
Walker?
Yeah.
Was that who it was? Yeah.
Well, there were a lot of spies in the 80s, but
they were caught and they're well known. But there was a lingering belief that there was a fourth individual spying on behalf of the Soviet Union within the United States military or intelligence community. And so that fourth man theory persisted at the agency and elsewhere, the FBI and elsewhere, for decades. And there's still debate among folks about whether or not that person existed. So
and where
I picked
do you
up,
come down on this issue?
I don't.
Come on, you're the legendary analyst.
No, I mean, I don't. I am an analyst on terrorism and counterterrorism.
Well, you have to read the book to know where she actually comes down on it.
She
does kind of address it. I'm sorry.
I do.
Spoiler alert.
But yes.
Is there a Russian spy out there that has not been unmasked?
Well, God, yes. There are Russian spies everywhere that haven't been unmasked.
The upper reaches of the United States government, I should have.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. It's time for a quick break. We'll be back in a moment.
So let me just not wanting to ruin the plot of this, just talk. There are a couple of themes that go through this conversation that's taking place via these two women between the revolutionary period and 2024. And one of the things that come up is what has and hasn't changed in terms of what a spy does, how they collect material, how they share material. And so let's just talk about how much the profession, I know obviously lots has changed in terms of technical things, et cetera, but in terms of what it takes to be a spy, what a spy needs to do, and why women might be particularly good at this. Do you want to, which, you know, refers to the title in its own way. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that? What's the same and what's different?
Yeah, no. And I mean, that is, thank you, because that is one of the themes I wanted to emphasize. Because with all the technology in the world, the reality is when you're trying to figure out what's going to happen next or what big you need to be worried about, there is nothing more valuable than the inside of the mind who gets to decide, right? And that may be a president or a prime minister or a premier or, you know, general or whoever. And getting inside somebody's mind, until we have some actual way of mind reading, is still the task of human intelligence collection. It's still the task of your typical CIA clandestine officer. You know, there's no substitute for that kind of access. And in exploring, you know, what do women, obviously, men and women both have advantages, men and women both have disadvantages. There's just no arguing that. Some of the advantages that women have had throughout the decades of, or 250 years of American spying, for example, is number one, no one believes they're up to anything. You know, that's, again, that backdrop of, well, it's just a woman, it's just a woman. And two, they have a different way of relating to people that, you know, comes genetically from our being hardwired to understand infants who can't talk, you know, and to understand nonverbal children requires an ability to understand facial features, movements, you know, body language in ways that is just comes more naturally, even if women aren't trying. So it's one of the reasons why we're always dismissed as being too sensitive. Well, that's a hardwiring mechanism in our brains. So anyway, there are ways of leveraging that and making use of it. And, you know, ultimately, I think that's what any workplace should be about. I've said this before, you know, we're all very different human beings, and every single person has a set of talents and skills that, if enabled fully, helps the team be so much better. So anyway,
I'd like to explore that a little about your own career at the CIA. As I mentioned before, you're primarily known as the first person within the intelligence community to identify the threat of Osama bin Laden, and you did that as early as 1993, which was way before anybody else was paying attention. So how did you get onto it? How did you make the connections, see the threat that others were oblivious to?
Well, first I want to make sure I fully answered Karen's question, because I believe there was a part of that that I didn't get to. So if you don't mind, I just finish?
As long as we come back to this.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Just in terms of the tradecraft being, you know, that essential part of the tradecraft still being about people and how people relate and communicate and create trust with each other, even when they shouldn't, you know, so when they should or they shouldn't. And I think that's what's really important. The other piece of it, though, that I was trying to get at is, you know, you do have two women who are still at odds with the sort of surrounding and the environment. And just seeing again how the fact that, you know, so many women have this ability to have faith in something, even when it's not going right, you know.
And in each other, which is sort of an interesting. Yeah,
it kind of, for me, it goes back to the family thing, right? The number of times I wanted to toss one or two of my kids out the, you know, car window, but you have to, you know, you cannot parent with, and I think all parents know this, you can't parent short term. You have to continue to have faith that, okay, I just got to keep at this and eventually they're going to get it. Eventually they're going to get it. And I think that's what you see in both of my characters, Ruth and Sarah.
Yeah.
Both of whom are modeled after people that I really knew, that I knew and cared about, you know, through the years, sort of composite people. But anyway, that I just wanted to finish that thought. So now
back to Osama bin Laden.
Okay. Well, here, my answer is twofold. Number one, I was new and I wasn't an expert on Cold War leftist Marxist terrorist groups. And I was curious enough and new enough to just read, you know, everything. I covered such a large swath of territory from South Asia to North Africa to Egypt to Southeast Asia and Europe. I was looking at all of this region, reading the intelligence information and the open source information about what was going on in the world of violence, you know, and I began seeing this outflow of men from Afghanistan, not Afghan nationals, but nationals from all over the world, who had gone there to volunteer to help fight, as today we would call them foreign fighters, who, you know, went to Afghanistan to support the Afghan resistance to the Soviet Union. But when the Soviet troops pulled out, you know, 1989, a lot of them left. It was no longer the war that they were supposed to be supporting. And when they went back home, they really infused a lot of local, particularly Islamic extremist movements, with a new fervor. You know, they had these street creds because they'd kicked out the Soviet Union, and a couple of years later, the Soviet Union dissolves. I mean, they were pretty influential in their circles. And so we began to see this increased violence across groups, again, across North Africa, everywhere I looked anyway, that had intensified and sort of refocused and had these individuals who were known as Afghan Arabs because they had fought in Afghanistan. And throughout that, first of all, I thought that was a troubling trend and no one else was watching it because we were still sort of stuck in an old structure of, you know, state-sponsored terrorism and Palestinians. So, you know, I kept digging at it and I thought it was new and disturbing. And then, throughout all of that, we kept hearing about this Saudi renegade or this Saudi individual who seemed to have a lot of money and a plan. And initially we just knew him as Abu Abdullah. But eventually we came to understand it was Osama bin Laden. But he kept popping up as someone who was facilitating individuals. You know, he had some role in helping this person get from there to Algeria into the, you know, the armed Islamic group, from there to Egypt, you know, with helping with the assassination attempt against Mubarak in 1995, I think it was. So he kept coming up. And so part of it was being in the right place at the wrong time, or the wrong place at the right time, whatever you want to call it, and having that curiosity and no one else following it. And, you know, and being humble enough to say, I don't know what the heck is going on. I'm going to keep on looking and following this. So that's
one
part.
But you wrote a memo on this, right?
Yeah.
What was it called?
The Wandering Mujahideen is the one you're thinking of.
The Wandering
Mujahideen. But I mean, I've written a lot of things, and, you know, some of it before that, but.
Right. So. This is 93. You're still at you're just going to the CIA from the State Department.
I've just actually given birth.
Okay.
I'm on three days of maternity leave or something like that.
And then who was your employer?
Oh, and I went to the agency after that.
Right. Okay. And what was did everybody at the agency read your stuff and say, aha, Gina's got it. This is what we have to be focused on. Or was it sort of, did it take time before people realized the truth of what you were revealing?
Yeah. I mean, people in the terrorism world, you know, in the counterterrorism world at the agency, they were not skeptical about it. I mean, some of the reporting came from agency collectors. A lot of it in the initial years came from, you know, foreign liaison partners who were telling us these little tidbits. But I didn't feel like you have to remember the counter-terror center at that time was tiny. Yeah, it was really small. And this is a place where you are the alternative future. I mean, that's the mindset there is the world is going to fall apart tomorrow. So that's not where the skeptics were. Yes, there were skeptics in the regional parts of the CIA and in the leadership, but it was also the peace dividend of the end of the Cold War, and Congress was trying to shut down the CIA or at least reduce our funding by a ridiculous amount of money. So it wasn't really the best time to be making an argument that someone who was not sponsored by a state, whose cohort came from multiple different countries, who wasn't really based anywhere specific or persistent, could possibly be a threat to the United States of America. We had just won the Cold War, right?
So the guy you identified, bin Laden, was a wealthy Saudi. 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. And there is the lingering controversy to this day about whether there were other Saudis involved. There's, you probably have read, there's a New York court case that's been going on for years. A federal judge just ruled that the plaintiffs, the families of 9/11 victims, have a plausible case that can proceed against the Saudi government itself for funding terrorism, and in particular, of course, helping to have a support network for the two hijackers who were in Southern California, one of whom, this guy Bayoumi, we've written about in Spy Talk, who was never charged and was allowed to return to Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that many in the FBI now believe he was involved in the plot. Your take on this continuing controversy about whether the 9/11 conspiracy included people in the Saudi government?
Well, I actually addressed that in the 60 Minute segment.
Well, address it more fully here on Spy Talk.
There's not really a lot to say. I don't believe that the Saudi government was involved.
Do you believe that there were elements of the Saudi government that were supporting the hijackers, as the plaintiffs in the New York case allege?
Yeah, but I don't think those are the same things.
Well, some of them had relationships with the Saudi government.
For sure.
The imam was funded, the Saudi funded.
But you can be working in a government and working for someone else at the same time, as we were just talking about Rick Ames and Robert Hansen and others.
Actually, I want to try to bring this conversation up to date a little bit, because one of the more interesting things about that I found about your book, which I just really liked. I just read it from cover to cover, and I found the characters great and the plot twist kind of like, wow, why didn't I think of that? You know, like that kind of thing. But one of the things you talk about when you're talking about 2024 is the Wagner Group. Mm-hmm. And Prigozhin, of course, was killed. And I was just kind of curious, if we're going to talk about what you're thinking about today, like, and you know, Michael began by asking you about what the threats today are, if not to the United States, then to, you know, geopolitical stability. You know, how do you see the Wagner Group right now? I mean, were they diffused because of Prigozhin's killing? Were they... Where do you think they are? Because you make them into a very powerful counterforce to Putin, which we know is what was happening, but it really takes on a life of its own in your book. And I'm just kind of curious how you see it today.
Yeah, well, again, I'm not a Russian expert.
Okay.
So, nor a Wagner expert. But, you know, what I know of non-state actors is they work on their own time, and we have this tendency to treat non-state actors, you know, to counter them the same way we do state actors, and it doesn't work. And the advantage of a network like the Wagner Group or Al-Qaeda or any other criminal organization is that they are a network and that they can survive on the move as well as dispersed, decentralized. And so I don't think they're as easy to crush as people want to believe. And I also think one of the biggest mistakes people like Putin or presidents make is that hubris of thinking that they've won, you know, and I think that's a big, big mistake. But I also really wanted to use the conversation about criminal organizations, oligarchic, you know, organizations like this, bringing in the profit motive and the commercialization, you know, the privatization of government and military and everything else, security, into the conversation. Because if people don't trust government, boy, are we in trouble. Because the profit motive, you know, and the narcissism, one of my inspirations was actually the movie WALL-E. You know that movie?
Yeah, of course.
One of the things I loved, and Disney. There are very few words in that movie, so that people from all over the world can understand the story. no matter what language you speak. I thought that was a brilliant move on Disney's part. But I think that's, you know, it's incredibly insightful how easily people allow themselves to be led while thinking they're making their own decisions. And we're in that space now where, you know, we look for information that confirms what we already think we know or want to hear. We don't want to be told something we don't want to know or don't want to hear. People are making lots of money off of that. It's just, I wanted to start us into that conversation because, you know, I can't help but still be like the warning analyst and, you know, inside. And I think there's so much, which, you know, this book is a part of a series. And so there's a lot more to go into. And it does, you know, it's fiction. And so I do take the element of, hey, while we're looking left, we should have been looking right. And while we're mm-hmm. looking up, we should have been looking down. And, you know, just because that's going to happen. It's part of the world.
Speaking of people looking for information that confirms what they want to hear, I've got another question from your days at the agency. I have read that during the run-up to the war in Iraq, you were asked to examine whether there was, in fact, ties, connections between Saddam Hussein's regime in Baghdad and al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. Tell us who asked you to do that, what you did, what you examined, and what conclusions you mm-hmm. reached and who you reported them to.
Sure. Well, shortly after 9/11, there were questions from the Oval Office as to, as well there should have been, who else might have been involved. You know, we had been able to point to al-Qaeda and you know, bin Laden on 9/11 itself. But, you know, asking who else. And I think you have to remember, too, the administration was new, fairly new. It was only a few months in, and it had not really caught up with the understanding the capacity of terrorist groups that weren't sponsored by a state yet. And so there was a lot of concern as to, you know, who else, Iran, who else, Iraq. You know, it wasn't just Iraq. And I didn't find that particularly surprising, having done counterterrorism for a really long time and having looked down the wrong avenue in past cases. In fact, oddly enough, in 1993, when the first World Trade Center bombing occurred, we looked at Iraq then because Saddam Hussein had tried to create an assassination attempt against George H.W. Bush. So they were high up on the list of suspects. They just weren't it just wasn't them that time. And so, you know, in CT, you can't, kind of like Sherlock Holmes, you can't decide ahead of time. You have to uncover and look with an open mind, as much of an open mind as you can. At the same time, it was a very busy time. We, for the life of us, did not believe that 9/11 was just one thing. Like, there were going to be more attacks, which, you know, some of which we were able to stop. So it was very busy. We didn't have enough people. And there were persistent questions about other possible actors being involved that initially, right, again, initially our gut instinct was no one else was involved. But we had to do the right thing, the diligence. And so I was asked to kind of take one for the team, pull myself off of al-Qaeda, and look at the possible links from the Iraq perspective to al-Qaeda. And I also looked at Iran to al-Qaeda as well. So that is how, and that happened in September of 2001. And with that, I did. I pursued the possibility of Iraq's involvement for a couple of years with, you know, every intention of looking at every possible asset, every possible report, with as much objectivity as I could muster. Even though, you know, my assessment was that al-Qaeda would not have trusted, but I did what I could in terms of looking everywhere and under everything, and to the annoyance of many people across the world who, you know, have to be on the other end of that. But we came up with no, we came up with nothing. In fact, I remember briefing the chain of command and explaining that it looked the relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, like that of Iran and Al-Qaeda, was very similar to a hostile, you know, a mutually hostile liaison relationship. We will meet with adversarial, you know, intelligence on occasion. You want to know what they're doing, and they want to know what you're doing, and that's what you do. And that's what we concluded, I think, after the fact, when we got a hold of a lot of the IIS files and all that stuff, you know, from Iraq. That's exactly, you know, it was confirmed. That's exactly what was going on. Saddam was trying to figure out what the Iraqi defectors in Al-Qaeda were up to, and parts of the Iraqi inclined and Levant area members of Al-Qaeda wanted to know what Saddam was up to, you know, so it was not cooperation.
So you say you briefed the chain of command. Are we talking about the vice president and the president together?
No, the vice president was enough.
The vice president. And it sounds like you were telling him something he didn't want to hear. How did he take it?
No, what was his reaction? He didn't want to hear. I mean, you know, national security advisors there, deputy national security advisor. I mean, it's... honestly, I think in that briefing, here's a takeaway that I was surprised I had. It was clear, this was, you know, after the anthrax letters too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I had not, I guess I had thought of the president and the vice president and the national security advisor as these superhuman beings, you know, and I saw the fatigue and this sense of personal responsibility to keep every single American safe. And so I had some sympathy for that. That was powerful in the room. He did not like what we had to say, but he respected it. I mean, Scooter Libby did not like what we had to say.
How did he express his displeasure?
These guys did not yell at us across the table or anything like that. It was professional. It was, well, we still want to hear, we still want to look at more, you know, we want you to look down this avenue, and of course, which we continue to do.
I mean, did you, some of the specifics were so, you know, have been so thoroughly debunked. Mohammed, yeah. Atta in Prague, oh, something, yeah. Cheney continually talked about. I assume you looked at it. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
in every conceivable way. Yeah. And I can't speak for why we couldn't convince them, but it's not like they went out in the public and said, well, the CIA is wrong and don't believe them. And it's not like they fired everybody in the CIA and made us write something new, for example, that was in alignment with the president. In fact, the president was very clear that he respected our objectivity,
yeah,
and
but
our
when
opinion.
Then, when you saw your boss, George Tenet, sitting behind Colin Powell at the United Nations saying pretty much precisely the opposite of what you had concluded, and they really, yes, no. Colin Powell got up there and talked about, now the story can be told. We have a defector who's told us that Al-Qaeda was provided chemical and biological weapons training by Saddam's regime. It was said by Colin Powell at the UN. This was the guy, Al-Libi, who was tortured by the Egyptians and then recanted the whole, yeah, story. Everything rested on that one claim, which totally was different than what you had concluded.
No, I mean, what the Powell speech was far more about was Iraq rebuilding
yeah,
its WMD.
Yeah, but there was an Al-Qaeda component to it.
Yeah, but
and
there
was
also
central to the case.
There was also a very robust discussion going on within the national security conversation, and the National Security Council, and a number of people who were very much of, no, it's not Iraq. And from day one, report,
right, of course,
that there was, you know, it was going to be about Iraq and going to be about Iraq. So yeah, that's, you know, so different things can be happening at the same time. And there was, I mean, some people tell the story that, you know, no matter what you said as
an official in the government, like, no, this is not the linkage we're making it out to be. The point was that a different narrative was taking over, but there was more than just the agency, to tell you the truth, that was mm-hmm. that was owning this non-attachment yeah. story. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you have a political you know, decision that whatever yeah. contradicts the facts. But to your point about institutional robustness, and you know, the agency survived and continued to do its work on, you know, what the threat of terrorism, state actors, etc., was, yeah. which is, I think, kind of interesting. So I want to know about the rest of this series. Like, how many books?
Oh, well, I'm halfway through the second already, but at least three. It depends on the readers and what they like.
And is it, do you keep, am I allowed to ask, do you keep keeping it rooted in part in the current day?
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, here's the thing. There's a lot of time travel work out there, which I love. There's a lot of sci-fi. There's a lot of spy thrillers. There's a lot of historical fiction. There's so many genres, and that's awesome. But what fascinates me is the different dimensions of impact that espionage has, and how fragile it all is. And this really struck me when, you know, Enigma and Bletchley Park and that whole effort was declassified finally in the 1990s. And I thought, my God, for decades, there have been thousands, if not tens of thousands of books written about military maneuvers and the war, you know, World War II. And now they all have to be rewritten because now, yeah. you know, what the militaries, the Allied militaries knew. So that changes things. And it's just like, how many people do you think who know at a minimum about the defeat, you know, in Jamestown or, you know, that area in the Revolutionary War, who don't know that there was a disinformation campaign that helped bring that about, right? So there's that. There's sort of like these hidden stories that people don't know about. And then there's the fragility of what if it had gone the other way? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and what would we be living with today?
Which you play out very nicely in this first book, I have to say.
That is really what I'm most fascinated about, is exploring, do you know what it might have been? And being able to ask the question, what might have been better, might it be a lot worse? And it's just thinking about that moment. And there are so many times, you know, in espionage throughout history, the Cold War, pre-Cold War, Civil War, there's so many times throughout history that is the case. It's almost accidental, luck, incidental, tangential to whatever's going on. Man, the outsized impact that the decision or the success or failure of the operation had. You know, speaking of going back to something you asked earlier, Karen, my students ask me this question every once in a while. Like, who was, going back to human intelligence and trying to get inside the mind of the person who's deciding the big picture, who has been the best penetration, the best asset we've ever been able to get, you know, who throughout our American intelligence history, who have we nailed? Obviously, we can't talk about anybody right now, but, you know, in the past that has been declassified, like, who was it? Like, who, right? Do you know
who's your candidate?
Yeah. Oh, tell us.
There's no candidate. It's a fact.
Yeah. Tell us.
Because it was the president of the country involved that we were at war with, who was, didn't know it, but had someone in his household spying on him.
Who are we talking
about? Every day, every single day. President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy. In his household, was Mary Bauer, a Black woman who he believed to be a slave and he believed to be ignorant and unable to read. And she was spying on everything he did, every meeting he had with his generals, and getting that back to another woman.
Who was she reporting to?
Elizabeth Van Loo, who was then reporting to Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah.
Well, that would make a good book.
Well, would it now?
You know,
I can't wait.
We've had CIA, and we had David McCloskey on the show a few weeks ago. I think we should do a whole panel of CIA spy writers. But anyway, Gina, I want to thank you. It's been a fascinating discussion. We covered a lot.
Yeah. Pretty random selection of topics, too.
Yeah, I know. It reflects our random interests.
Yeah.
But I do want to thank you. It was
sure.
It was
thank
really
you.
And the name of the book again?
If Two of Them Are Dead.
If Two of Them Are Dead.
Yeah.
Okay.
And everybody should read it. It is an absolutely terrific read and makes you think about a lot of things you might not be thinking about.
Yeah.
It's good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW. Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.